Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. I'm Susan Liebel at St. Joseph's University, and today I welcome Donna L. Kurd to discuss her new book, Polarized and Demobilized, Legacies of Authoritarianism in Palestine. The book was published by Oxford University Press in 2020. Dr. L. Kurd is a researcher at the Arab Center for Research and Policy Studies and assistant professor at its sister institution, the Doha Institute for Graduate Studies in Qatar. She specializes in comparative politics and international relations of the Arab world. Welcome to the podcast, Donna.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, two general questions motivate your research. What demobilizes a once mobilized society? And how does international involvement amplify or suppress these dynamics? And in your case study of Palestine, you conclude that the Palestinian Authority more successfully demobilized as an indigenous institution than the Israelis were able to do as occupiers. And this is from the book. You say, despite Israel's greater resources and international backing, the Palestinian Authority was able to utilize its ties within society and covert authoritarian strategies to accomplish what Israeli oppression was unable to do. Polarize and demobilize the Palestinian population. I love books that have great titles that give us the thesis right away, and yours certainly does. But that's not the end of the story. You say that international pressures from countries, including the United States, also account for growing polarization and authoritarianism. So, well, let's start with how it is that involvement from countries such as the United States create a disjuncture between the Palestinian Authority and Palestinian society. Like, why did it matter so much for others to get involved from the outside?
Yeah, so basically, we know from a lot of literature on authoritarianism that even authoritarian regimes, they do face you know, what we call audience costs. They do have some feedback loops within their own society. That doesn't mean that they're, you know, obviously not 100% accountable or whatever, but at the end of the day, that there's some mechanisms of societal pressure on the regime and vice versa. But with the Palestinian Authority specifically, and I argue that this kind of dynamic, you know, replicates itself in other countries in the Middle East. With the Palestinian Authority, we find that the international intervention, it disrupts the feedback loop between Palestinian leadership and Palestinian society. First, by insulating the regime from their society, basically. So if the regime is able to, is either pushed into taking, you know, measures that it doesn't necessarily want to take, or sometimes conducts itself or, you know, pursues particular policies, it knows it's is unpopular with the society, but it also knows that they'll be protected as, you know, the American partner or the partner with Israel, according to the 1994 Oslo Accords. So basically, in that sense, it insulates the regime, and it inserts, so international intervention also inserts itself into decision making within the regime, and all of this leads to dynamics where different groups in society are no longer able to exert pressure on their leadership, even if not through democratic institutions necessarily, but they're no longer able to, as they have done in the past. It gives space for the regime to become more and more authoritarian.
Thanks so much. I think it will be helpful to the potential readers, the listeners today, to understand a little bit about how mobilized a society Palestine was before the occupation. So I was wondering if you could flesh that out a little bit. What characterized the Palestinian society? You describe it as highly mobilized. What did that look like?
Yeah, so actually, basically the periods that I talk about in the book are after 1948. So it's after the occupation, and particularly after the 1967 war, when Israel occupied the remaining parts of historic Palestine and the Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza. And what I mean when I say that it was highly mobilized is that despite the fact that Palestinian society lived under this military occupation, they were able to sustain, these organizations within society, a pretty vibrant civil society, women, unions, all sorts of student groups that were able to organize themselves in the absence of, official Palestinian institutions. Under military occupation, and they were able also to exert pressure on the Israeli occupation at certain parts of their history. So we have in the late 80s, we had the First Intifada, which means the Palestinian, it means in Arabic uprising. So the first Palestinian uprising in the late 1980s, where this, they were able to maintain a high level of coordination in the face of high levels of repression. They mostly adhered to a nonviolent strategy. They were able to get most of society to adhere to that strategy, most groups to adhere to that strategy. And that's not a small feat for people who lack these official kinds of institutions or government institutions that exist to represent them. And they're, again, they were able to get concessions from the Israeli occupation during that time. And even in the late 90s, early 2000s, when the second Palestinian Intifada, it was much more fragmented for reasons I explain in the book, but still they were able to sustain a high level of protest. They were able to sustain strikes. They were able to face the occupation when conditions became untenable. Now, fast forward to today, and this is no longer the case. There have been conditions that are worsening, really, in the Palestinian territories. More land seizures, more restrictions, more repression, and Palestinians have not been able to sustain themselves to the wide degree that once existed in protest or in any sort of mobilization. We still have pockets of mobilization. Certain protest movements erupting in reaction to very localized events, but it's not how it was, 20, 30 years ago, where, wide swaths of society are engaging in the same protest movement.
You emphasize in the book that before 1994, Palestinian society had, as you say, this sort of rich civil society. It was organized. There were a lot of organizations, and you attribute it to education and also reaction to the Israeli occupation. And I was wondering if you want to flesh that out just a little bit.
I'm building on work that's done by other, great scholars on this topic, like Wendy Perlman. But basically, Palestinian society was the most educated society in regional comparison. And because of that, because of the high rate of people going to colleges and engaging with other types of Palestinians from other, segments of society, you found that they were pretty good about organizing themselves around different political groups, around different identities. And that was the case, you know, for a long period of time after 1967, after the Israeli occupation, up to, like you mentioned, 1994. There was obviously the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was like a national liberation movement that functioned out of a number of different countries outside of historic Palestine. And they had their ties to certain groups and certain leadership in the Palestinian territories itself. But for the most part, much of this organizing was very much organic and grassroots. And the Palestinian Liberation Organization was not heavy-handed or like directing this kind of organization that was happening in the Palestinian territories before 1994. Now, what happens in 1994 is that the Palestinian Liberation Organization, as the representative of the Palestinian people, you know, officially, they sign the Oslo Accords with the Israeli government. And the idea is, you know, it's going to set up a state. So many of the Palestinian Liberation Organization leadership and you know, the cadres that exist in that organization, they return to the Palestinian territories for the first time. And that creates, you know, different dynamics where much of those grassroots organizations that existed kind of are co-opted or fall by the wayside.
No, that's really helpful. So before we go walk through the chapters, which are so well organized, I want to say to everybody listening that I sometimes fear the comparative politics books, the names, the dates, the methodology that's not necessarily my own. This is a book that really makes the history, the people, the periods, and how the work is being done so clear. It's beautifully written. And because of that, I'm going to actually use the chapters as a way of getting us through the argument and some of the most interesting parts of the empirical case. But let me ask you a little bit about how you chose the case. Sometimes people think about the Palestinian Authority as atypical because it's not a full state. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you chose the Palestinian Authority as the case study that helps you answer these more general questions and how it is that it applies to other regimes, given that it isn't the typical state.
Yeah, definitely. First of all, thank you so much for your kind words about the book. The short answer is that the Palestinian Authority is atypical. Obviously, it's kind of a quasi-state. It's still functioning in this kind of occupation. There's no part of the Palestinian territories that is free of Israeli occupation, even the areas that the Palestinian Authority controls. So 100% it is atypical in that sense. But for me, I thought it was a good case, first because I was interested in the case itself, you know, on its own merits. I'm interested in why this society that was highly mobilized, how did it become demobilized? I'm interested in those dynamics. What's the role that authoritarianism is playing in, what societal impacts is authoritarianism having on this dynamic? But also, I think that it features many of, the same variables and the same relationships that we find in the rest of the region. So it's, even though it's kind of a quasi-state, Palestinian state institutions exist. They exist in, very real, tangible ways, brick and mortar. They have an impact on people's lives. And it's not that, strange in the region to have such penetrated regimes. And by penetrated, I mean where there's a lot of like international presence and a lot of international intervention, including something like the Israeli occupation. So for me, it's a matter of degrees. The Palestinian Authority as a case might be a highly penetrated case. But, mm-hmm. You can account for that in the analysis and in one of the later chapters in the book, I try to apply the same argument to less penetrated cases, across what I call a state sovereignty spectrum. So for me, I thought that many of the same dynamics exist in the Palestinian case that exist elsewhere in the Arab world, where there's these regimes that are becoming more insulated from their societies because of international intervention to some degree, and how that authoritarianism, these decades of authoritarianism, are having, you know, a societal impact on, you know, capacity for collective action, on polarization, and on many of the variables that I'm interested in. So for me, that was the reason why I chose it, because it was interesting, you know, in itself, but also it spoke to the rest of the region.
So one of the things I love about books is the acknowledgments, because there is always some interesting story in them. And also it's interesting to watch an author thank the people who've helped them along the way. And you're an incredibly gracious scholar who acknowledges the support you've received. At one point in the acknowledgments, you thank the employees of the Palestinian authorities, institutions, for making time to be interviewed and sharing their expertise. And then you stop and you mention that in Palestinian society, particularly within the diaspora, it's easy to dismiss the people who work for the Palestinian Authority, you say, as traitors, as collaborators with Israeli occupation. And you note that it's become common to contrast the traitorous and the collaborators with the heroes and the resistors. So I was wondering if you would explain the challenge of writing this case, given that tendency. And second, if you'd also just tell us a little bit about the methods that you use in the book to try to understand the public, elites, and what you call a sort of mixed method of quantitative and qualitative approaches.
Sure. I've never actually been asked about my acknowledgments before. This is super fun for me to talk about, actually. So there's kind of a tendency, particularly, like I said, in the acknowledgments, for people who have a distance from, you know, they're far away, they theorize about what's happening on the ground, but they're not on the ground, they're not facing the same pressures, to lack nuance. And that kind of, you know, that part of the acknowledgments was written to people in my own community who are not being nuanced about the situation. Because at the end of the day, what I'm trying to explain to a large degree in this book is that, you know, sometimes we arrive at suboptimal outcomes in spite of people's, you know, best attempts.
Right.
Not to, you know, whitewash any bad policies that the Palestinian Authority engages in, and, you know, Lord knows there are many, not to get, you know, to let any Palestinian leader off the hook for any kind of mistakes they've made. But at the end of the day, a lot of these people, including many of the elites that, you know, some of the senior officials that I you know, was in contact with and I interviewed for the book, that they, you know, many of them, either they had been in exile all their lives, or they had established themselves in the diaspora and dropped everything to go back after 1994, because they truly believed that this was a turning point. And they truly believed in the promise that was given to them in 1994 with the Oslo Accords, that in 5 years, they were going to have their own state. And even though it was a state on the remnants of what they remembered as their society, they were willing to take that. And so we can't possibly just dismiss all of their motivations as being self-serving or something like this. Like, what's happening is more structural. Basically what I'm trying to argue is how the Palestinian Authority began to play this role of suppressing its own people. And it found itself in this bind of having to answer to their Israeli and American patrons in spite of what their society wanted. That wasn't what anybody signed up for necessarily. And that was by design in the Oslo Accords rather than as, you know, some personal choice made by some bureaucrats. I don't know if that makes sense, but that was basically.
No, it's very clarifying. No, it's terrific. Thank you.
Yeah. So that was why I wanted to, you know, write that somewhere in the book to say that there was more nuance than people often talk about. In terms of the mixed methods, so I was, you know, trained in kind of a mixed methods department and also engaged in a lot of, you know, workshops that are available to graduate students and things like this that could help me develop different kinds of methods, because I firmly believe that, you know, depending on what the research question is, like you kind of have to use the tool that's most suited to that research question. And because my research question was it was kind of large and it had a large timeline that I was talking about and many different relationships I was interested in. So I really needed to break down this kind of overall dynamic into, you know, very specific research questions. I try to address one for each chapter and use whatever tools are best to corroborate my theoretical argument in each chapter. So in the first empirical chapter, I use a nationally representative survey and I embed a survey experiment as well as these interviews I did with Palestinian Authority political leadership. And then in the next chapter, I use lab and field experiments, in addition to some interviews I did with different activists from different groups in Palestinian politics, as well as these case studies of different protest movements in villages and these kinds of marginalized spaces in the Palestinian territories. And then I also use an original data set of protest data covering from 2007 to 2016, which is the time frame that I argue in the book represents the consolidation of the Palestinian Authority. And that protest data helps me basically confirm some of the conclusions of the earlier chapters. Is the Palestinian Authority actually having an impact on mobilization where it controls territory? And that's what I try to do there. And then the case studies in the end are intended to see how well the argument travels to other cases. And I look at Iraqi Kurdistan and Bahrain. So basically I'm very eclectic mix, but I'm just using whatever is available to triangulate the data from, come at it from different perspectives.
So Donna, when you did your field work and you did the face-to-face interviews with the people working for the Palestinian Authority, how did you find them? Were they suspicious of you? How open were they? How do they think about you? And is there something you need to do to make them less suspicious, more open, et cetera?
Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, honestly, because I mean, I think that something should be, many people have written about this, I'm sure, and perhaps I should write something myself about how being a native to the case, both represents opportunities and challenges. So for me, Palestinian society is pretty close-knit. People may not know me personally, but they know people I'm related to. They know people, they know who I am kind of in a societal context. That represented opportunities in the sense that they were more forthcoming. They did not assume necessarily ill intent or anything like this. And many were very honest. I was surprised how honest, but one of them literally, so I was doing an interview with somebody and then, somebody walked in and interrupted the interview. And so introductions were made and this person looked at me and said, "You have to write a dissertation explaining how we got to this mess." And so many of them were very forthcoming because I was, they had this assumption that, I'm from Jerusalem. I'm part of their society. They didn't necessarily suspect me for those reasons. But in other senses, it can pose challenges because you also have the, baggage that might come into the interview that you as a researcher don't necessarily have, but because maybe somebody in your family is from a particular political group, there are assumptions made. So you just have to, clarify very, honestly and clearly, what your positionality is and what you're doing and, go through all of that and build trust. And I didn't use any kind of ethnographic methods necessarily in this book, but interestingly, I it kind of tipped me off that in future research I should kind of build on the ethnographic tools that might be useful in this kind of context, because you really do need to build trust with your participants sometimes in these kinds of more, you know, contexts that have more repression and more suspicion.
No, Heath Brown, who used to be one of the hosts of this show, is now doing a podcast about collaborative writing. You know, what is the process that people go through when they're not just doing their own scholarship? And a conversation about people who do field work, both as insiders and as outsiders, would really be fascinating, because I think you're right that there's advantages, disadvantages. On the one hand, you maybe bought a certain insider status. On the other hand, you might be seen as a traitor if you write something critical. So it's really a difficult line to walk.
Yeah, that was definitely a concern for me, because I wanted to be as fair as possible. But objectivity does not mean neutrality. This is something that Dr. Azim Shoto is an Arab thinker. He says often, which is, I can be objective even if perhaps, you know, I have a particular opinion about something that's happening, right? And I really wanted to be objective and fair. And that was one of my concerns, is I didn't want people to think that I was like a native informant of some kind. I'm not sure how much I achieved that, but that's a tension I do have to think about when I was writing the book.
Oh, I think you were very, very successful, Donna.
No, thank you.
But let's do the chapters of the book. We've done some of chapter one, which is the theory, the how these mechanisms and dynamics work. But you may want to add something before we move to chapter two.
Yeah, sure. So basically, let me just go through kind of the theoretical argument, if you don't mind.
Oh, please. No, we want it.
Okay. So basically the book, it kind of looks at a two-part causal chain. The first part looks at the impact of international involvement on the Palestinian Authority. And then the second part looks at the impact of Palestinian Authority on society, kind of that externally penetrated Palestinian Authority on society. So that first half of the causal chain is basically attempting to test theories of international involvement. And not in the sense that like my one case can prove or disprove existing theories on international involvement, but in the sense that kind of in the George and Bennett sense of using a case to highlight the scope conditions on existing theories. And then the second half of the causal chain serves much more theory building purposes. Again, in the George and Bennett, framework, it's kind of like a heuristic case study in the sense that it's trying to illuminate, you know, new relationships, new variables. And that second part is basically making the argument that there's a link between authoritarianism and polarization and capacity for collective action. So basically my hypotheses are that authoritarian strategies generate polarization because when authoritarian regimes use different strategies selectively, targeting certain groups while co-opting others, this itself is causing polarization because the group that is, repressed shares in a common trauma and there, you know, it builds kind of in-group and out-group dynamics. And then the second part of the causal, the theoretical argument is the link between polarization and collective action. So because of this kind of selective authoritarian strategy situation, basically I argue that it causes polarization, and that translates to collective action because it breeds insularity within groups and grievousness between them, making it, you know, more and more difficult for groups to either initiate mobilization or coordinate with others. And I have, a number of different reasons. I don't know how much detail I should go into, but basically that's kind of the theoretical argument. Then the whole idea is to see how was this long-lasting kind of legacy of authoritarianism impacting how people coordinate with each other, how society works.
Now, that's a beautiful overview. Thank you so much. Let's talk about chapter two, and if we need to, we'll go back to some of the theory as you sort of bring out some of the findings. So The second chapter is called Americans Have Taught Us. There's a difference between democracy and creating problems. So what effect did international involvement have on the preferences of the Palestinian leadership and the public and the Palestinian public? Because you distinguish those two. And so I think that would be a good place for us to start.
Right. Yeah. So basically, I outlined in the chapter using these interviews I did with Palestinian political leadership in different ministries and different positions. Because of international involvement, particularly American involvement, that perhaps used the rhetoric of democracy but pushed policy in a very different direction, including in 2006 when basically the George Bush administration was pushing for elections to happen in the Palestinian territories because they wanted to say, like, you know, there was this whole paradigm of democracy promotion, and they wanted to say that they had helped the Palestinians go through democratic elections. And what that did was it brought people from the Islamist party, Hamas, to power through very fair and free elections. And so instead of accepting those fair and free elections, basically American decision makers supported certain factions in the outgoing political party, Fatah, to mount a coup and to take back control. And that's what happened. And that caused a huge rift in the Palestinian territories that exists until this day. So we have two different governments, one in Gaza and one in the West Bank. And that occurred because of American intervention. And that's just, you know, that's the most stark example, but it happens in small ways on an everyday basis as well. So these people that I interviewed would tell me, you know, we would want to put together a training program. We have money to put together a training program. But then the Americans would look at the list of people that we're inviting for the training program, and they would tell us to remove certain people that they didn't agree with politically, or that had history of protest, or that had been arrested for, facing the occupation at some point in their life or whatever. So it happens kind of in very small ways and in very big ways, this American intervention that pushes the Palestinian Authority to be much less, accountable to its public. And so what happens, and I detail this in the book, what happened particularly after 2006, and that was a huge kind of rupture in Palestinian politics and even in people's thinking, was that, you know, Palestinian elites started to kind of internalize this. It's like, you know what, maybe we're not ready for democracy. Because even when we want to, like, you know, the international community doesn't back us up, and people, you know, the Americans get involved, and what happens is we turn guns on each other, and there's no benefit to doing it. So maybe we're not ready for democracy. They start to kind of use these arguments to assuage the cognitive dissonance, basically to say, you know, we're a Palestinian society. We're not ready for democracy. We're not ready for these accountability mechanisms. We need to get ready. And clearly we're not ready because the Americans say so, right? So that's at the level of the elites. And then at the public level, I think the assumption in some of the literature is that, you know, the elites are anti-democratic, and then the public is, you know, they would always want more democracy. But what I find is it's a little bit more nuanced, because the Palestinian Authority is, you know, one of the biggest employers in town as well. And it employs large segments of of Palestinian society, and it represents large segments of Palestinian society in that sense. What we find when I did the survey is that certain segments of the Palestinian population want democracy and accountability. And certain segments are wary of it for reasons, you know, related to international intervention and possible international intervention. And basically the line is that if you are employed by the Palestinian Authority, or if you have a family member employed by the Palestinian Authority, you're more likely to be wary of calls for democracy, calls for accountability, because you're worried that international patrons will get involved, that the Israeli tanks will roll down the streets, that the Americans will arm a certain faction to engage in a coup. Whereas the parts of society that are less connected to the Palestinian Authority, maybe they're not directly employed or they work in the private sector or whatever, they are much more supportive of democracy and accountability. The international dimension is less worrisome for them, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And it really brings us to the next part of the book, which is, that explains how it is that the Palestinian Authority could become authoritarian in this way. And then the next chapter is looking at, what is the effect of that authoritarianism on the polarization within Palestinian society and how it affects their ability for collective action? So very briefly, if you could just lay out a little bit of what happens in chapter 3 for us.
Yeah, so you get this kind of inclination from the first chapter that there is this kind of polarizing divide, people who are connected to the Palestinian Authority and people who are not. I wanted to test it kind of in more depth. What exactly about what kinds of authoritarian strategies are are doing the work here? Which aspects of society? Which segments? So all of that I kind of wanted to work through. And so I utilized the lab and field experiment conducted at Birzeit University, which is a university in the West Bank that's pretty nationally representative in the sense that it has people from all walks of life in Palestinian society come to Birzeit. So for that reason, I thought that it would be a good kind of context to test these dynamics. And I conducted these lab experiments where I asked my participants to sort themselves into different political affiliations, let me know what political affiliation they were they most agreed with. And then one is the political party that's in control in the Palestinian Authority, which is Fatah. And then there's the Islamist party, and then there's the leftist party. And then I, asked them questions about whether or not they would be willing to work with others, whether or not they would be willing to protest with others, whether or not they would be willing to sign a petition or sign up, a certain number of hours to engage in a campus campaign. And what I found was really interesting is that when they were reminded of repressive strategies on the part of the PA, groups that are considered, for lack of a better word, kind of out groups, the groups that are not in power, the groups that are in reality actually being repressed, they were the ones least likely to want to work with others. They were the ones that were most likely to be more, express more insular views and to have more grievances with other groups. Whereas the group that affiliated with the ruling party Fatah, which is the party that's in power in the Palestinian Authority, this did not impact them. When you prompted them with mentions of repression or anything like that, they know that this is not something that is impacting them in real life. Repression didn't have an impact on them. Co-optation, priming didn't have an impact on them. Whereas the groups that are actually marginalized, they become more insular and express more grievances with groups across the political spectrum and much less likely to work with them, with others. And so that was kind of a breakthrough for me, is like how these authoritarian strategies directly impact how people view one another and how people work with each other. And so that was the takeaway from the third chapter. And I also conducted interviews with activists. So let's see if this is actually traveling outside the lab. And did these kind of little case studies of protest movements in different villages in Palestine where protest movements emerged and then devolved, and why did they devolve, and whether or not the dynamics that I found in the lab experiment actually existed outside.
Donna, did you find when you were looking at the impact of authoritarian strategies differences in terms of gender? Are women as likely to be activists? Are they affected by the authoritarian, or do they use authoritarian measures in ways that are different from the male activists?
So I did not focus on gender, truth be told, in the like qualitative interviews. In the experiments, I didn't find any kind of statistically significant difference between the genders. But I think that that's a really interesting component that I, you know, I would be interested even to build on, because just from, you know, purely anecdotal evidence, and also the, you know, some new research that's emerging from other scholars, that there might also be a gender component as to which groups women are more likely to engage with, and mm-hmm. you'd be surprised that it might all, it, you know, there is an inclination for women to actually engage more with the Islamist groups than we might think. But, you know, that's not the, that wasn't the focus of my research. So I don't want to speak out of turn, but I think that there is something there. And I think that some, you know, some scholars that are currently working on this, they're picking up on it. And I would be interested in building on that work.
We've talked a lot about the Palestinian case, but the book ends with an exploration of what it is that is more generalizable and that could be seen in other contexts. So very briefly, I was wondering how it is that this kind of international involvement and demobilization can be seen elsewhere.
Yeah, so I have the chapter on protest data that comes after the lab and field experiments, where I test the conclusion of the previous chapter. And then the last chapter is the chapter where I see if this kind of travels to cases that I, like I said, are on the state sovereignty spectrum. So Palestine, we'd consider like the least sovereign because they're under, you know, direct military occupation. And then there's the case of Iraqi Kurdistan, which is more sovereign because, you know, constitutionally the KRG, the Kurdish regional government, is allowed to exist. It's kind of a semi-sovereign status. And then there's the case of Bahrain, which is, you know, a full state, considered fully sovereign. But for reasons I explained in the chapter, there are high levels of international intervention across all of these. And I talk about how this international intervention may have insulated political leadership in all three of these cases, much like the case of the Palestinian Authority, and increased authoritarianism, much like in the case of the Palestinian Authority, and polarized Kurdish society, as well as Bahraini society. And so I talk about how American intervention with, you know, different Kurdish liberation groups at certain stages in Iraqi Kurdistan's history basically insulated them, caused them to engage in very authoritarian repressive dynamics. There were attempts to challenge these kinds of, you know, entrenched political elites in Iraqi Kurdistan, but they were able, because they're, you know, they have these institutional ties to the United States and to other patrons, they were able to, you know, suppress attempts to challenge them. And Iraqi Kurdish society is become increasingly polarized between the KDP and the PUK. So that was one aspect. And in the Bahrain case, I look at Bahrain, particularly after the Arab Spring, and the impact of Saudi and American intervention on the protests. And I build on Justin Gengler's work. So basically what we find is that at the beginning of the Arab Spring, we have Bahrainis from different backgrounds engaging in the protests. But, you know, eventually, especially because of international backing for the regime is able to, you know, drive a wedge between them, and the entire uprising becomes much more sectarian. And we, you know, the impact of that continues to this day, is that the opposition in Bahrain has become much more sectarian and much more polarized along sectarian lines between Sunni and Shia than perhaps it was inclined at the beginning of the Arab Spring, or even in the history of Bahrain. So I look at even before the Arab Spring as well, in the the political groups that existed that were not along sectarian lines, you know, in the 60s and 70s. So yeah, that's kind of what I tried to do in the last chapter, to show how externally backed authoritarianism, you know, operates in more or less similar fashion across different cases. So it's not just an issue of Palestine, and it's not just an issue of this society that's under occupation, but it's how external intervention is disrupting the feedback loop between state and societies in much of the region.
So before we end, and I want to ask you what your next project is, but before we do that, the what you learned about Palestine, what does it, how do you take what you've learned about Palestine and project what might happen or how we might watch for developments with a different eye going forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little, you know, predictions, like, it's a tough game to predict, I'd say. But I think that work like the research in my book and a number of other scholars that work on this has showed that because of these dynamics, where we're going to find opposition emerging and where we're going to see mobilization happening are places we wouldn't traditionally think to look. You know, for example, in before 1994, before the Palestinian Authority, we'd find that, you know, the cities are more mobilized than the rural areas, obviously, because there's more institutions, there's more civil society, there's like greater populations that can engage in protest. But now it's the reverse, really. We're finding that mobilization is happening on the margins in these rural communities, in places where, you know, civil society in the traditional sense is not as strong. So it's that is kind of, you know, the predictions, let's say, of my book on that front. You know, we see that, I think, in reality, coming to fruition. But in terms of the dynamics of, you know, this very authoritarian Palestinian Authority and their relationship to their own society, because of how much they're beholden to American and Israeli patronage, the current dynamic with the Trump administration pressuring the Palestinian Authority, cutting aid, fully, even more fully supporting the Israeli occupation than ever before, even supporting Israeli annexation, as has recently been the case, of the Palestinian territories, what this actually might represent for the Palestinian leadership is an opening. If they, you know, obviously some political agency is at work here, but if they're willing to take it, because for the first time in what, like two decades, they are not as beholden to their American patrons as they once were. They're, you know, the United States has already cut aid. The United States has already pushed them into a corner. The Israelis, they're not even pretending to engage in the peace process anymore. They're talking about annexation. So this represents, you know, a critical juncture for Palestinian leadership. Like, if you want things to change, this is the moment in time to reach out to your own society, to empower your own society, and to actually act as representatives of your society. You know, I wrote something about this back in November. Tarek Mokoni wrote something about this, I think, in the New York Times a few months after. So people are kind of picking up on this, that, like, if the dynamics of externally, you know, external intervention are ruptured in this moment in time, maybe that means a way forward for the Palestinian leadership and its society to engage in a less, you know, authoritarian dynamic. But again, it's hard to predict, because at the end of the day, like, these are people and political agency matters, and, you know, people might make decisions that go otherwise. But that's kind of my two cents on the matter.
No, that's really, really helpful. Look, and it's also very, very hard to rebuild civil society when it's been had the threads pulled out from it.
Right.
Before we go, can you tell me a little bit about what you're working on right now? I know this book is just out, but
yeah.
What's the next project?
So when I was writing this book, it was building on my dissertation. The dynamics in the Middle East were that the United States was the crucial actor in many cases, but that is changing. I think there was a recent book out by Dan Nixon and Alexander Cooley called "Exiting Hegemony." I think people are recognizing that, you know, particularly in certain regions, other actors might be coming to the fore, and how that's going to be impacting politics is kind of a question that needs to be addressed. So my next project is looking at similar dynamics, but particularly authoritarian diffusion within the Arab world, and how different authoritarian regimes within the Arab world, particularly as the Americans exit, how they're impacting each other, how there are these technologies of repression that are proliferating, and how that's impacting society and its ability to oppose current political dynamics, specifically focusing on other regional powers like the Emirates, like Israel, and their impact on the diffusion of authoritarianism in the region.
Well, that sounds really fascinating. This book, which is Polarized and Demobilized, Legacies of Authoritarianism in Palestine by Donna L. Kurd, is available on the Oxford University Press website. It's available through Indie, Bookshop, Barnes & Noble, Amazon. We encourage everybody in this time with bookstores closed to try to reach out and find places that will get you the book. And I recommend it to all. It's clearly written, and it's got a fascinating story and very, very important questions that are generalized beyond this case. So thank you so much for joining us today, Donna.
Thank you for having me.